tell someone. Tell an RA, counselor, parent, or doctor. Call the Youth Support Line at 1-888-821-3760.
Tune into Viejoteca every Tuesday from 6 to 8 p.m. on CFRU 93.3 on the FM dial, or listen online at www.cfru.ca, Canada's number one salsa radio show. Vaya.
A todos en general, yo les quiero dedicar.
Hi, my name is Peter, and I volunteer at CFRU because it's a space that really encourages creativity and expressing yourself.
My name is Stacy. I love discovering music that sounds good to me. All kinds of music.
I love the people, I love the atmosphere, and everyone loves radio, and you can tell.
If you love radio and would like to get involved, volunteer at CFRU. No previous experience is required, and we provide all the training. Check out our website at cfru.ca or call Christopher at 519-824-4120, extension 58341, or email volunteer@cfru.ca.
Volunteering at CFRU breeds minds, breeds culture. So come on down.
You're listening to CFRU 93.3 FM in Guelph, your community station.
Here we are. We're back. I'm back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM. I am Siegfried, and I am here with Mr. Sean Goodman, who is... We just have to readjust the mic for.
There we go.
Hold on a second.
Good evening, everyone.
Yeah. And this is Sean. And Sean, like, when was the last time you did... I don't think you've ever come on back in the USSR.
This is my first time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We're really breaking some new ground here. This is classic.
I know. Yeah. Our relationship's just reaching a whole nother level.
You bet it is.
I know. I should have been on sooner. I mean, you've been on my now defunct show. Well, you
Distorted
were.
Distorted Reality.
Yes. Yep. Distorted Reality. You were on it numerous
a
times.
Lot of,
I can't
quite
even
a few
count.
Times, yeah. Like, it was kind of an institution. Like, every few weeks, at least, I was in there. Like, 2-3 weeks,
Yeah. Well, Ayrton and I always loved having you on.
Yeah, well, thank you very much. And, like, it was some pretty amazing stuff we were playing. Like, even, like, 8-bit kind of... kind of stuff was rather entertaining. And, like,
yeah,
this,
yeah.
We get,
I guess,
like, Diablo soundtrack music and stuff, and it was a lot of fun.
Definitely some good, really great video game episodes.
Yeah, those bring back memories.
I know. I remember we were reminiscing in the studio and, you know, talking about how we spent our childhood in front of a TV, naturally.
Yeah, in front of a TV.
Which I think, you know, the majority of people in the Western world could probably
say. With me,
that.
It was more of a computer screen, but, you know, yeah, DOS games and stuff like that. Like, it was just, wow, I'm old. The fact that I can remember that.
Good old Windows 95.
Windows 95.
I don't think I'm not quite old enough for to remember playing DOS games.
Oh, well, like,
but,
yeah.
Windows 95,
you,
I was
you remember
all up
that.
On that.
Yeah, but tonight we're actually going to be talking a little bit about the experimental music that was in the Soviet Union. Which is, once again, something that does not get talked about too much in the Western media, or really, you know, a lot of this stuff, like, doesn't even get any airtime outside of, outside of Russia, probably, like, these days.
Yeah, yeah, no, it is.
Released Eastern
really
Europe.
Unfortunate. And it's a really interesting, you know, scene, a really rich history of,
yeah.
You know, electronic music in Russia.
So, like, I didn't even know, like, half the stuff about this until, like, you know, well, frankly, a few days ago when I started, like, finally preparing for this show. I kind of procrastinated a little bit. But it's pretty amazing, especially in the 1980s. I guess this mostly it really became a big thing in the 70s, like, with the electronic music. And that was when it really kind of took off. And it was in a lot of, like, see, a lot of this kind of stuff kind of grew up alongside a major movement in, like, Soviet film. You know, where it was like, okay, you have, like, a lot of new, like, sci-fi films and stuff like that coming out. And I know we were talking about Solaris earlier, which is, like, kind of like the big film. I guess That's one of the films which I guess people in the West might know about.
Yeah, well, I think
it might even be at the public library downtown.
Yeah, Guelph. A lot of people would probably think of the George Clooney remake.
Yeah,
but yeah, it was originally like a 1970s.
Yeah, like mid-70s. Sci-fi. Yeah, like sci-fi film. I think it was like 73, 74, maybe 75. I can't remember the exact date, but it was somewhere in there. And that was like really, really huge. It actually like made it beyond like, say, the communist bloc, whatever it is. But I mean, like, but even going back to, like, say, the 1920s, I mean, there were like even silent sci-fi films coming out in Russia, you know, around the same time they were making like films like Battleship Potemkin. And, like,
yeah, that, I was like actually that. Just going to mention, you know? That. And yeah, I'd say yeah. that, yeah, Russia does have a very rich film history.
Yeah. Because there was a whole film. It was called a Rodney, I think it was called. And it was like a film about human beings going to Mars and discovering like civilization there and stuff. And they're this is a really oppressive civilization. They find that actually introduced communism to Mars.
Interesting.
And it's like really, really interesting. And this came out like 1924 or something. You know, like it was really, really early. It was one of the first kind of films which really came out in Russia around that time. And it's... And, you know, I was just seeing like clips of it on YouTube like a few days back and stuff like that, and thinking like, wow, this actually is pretty profound. I mean, it's talking about like, okay, you know, comrades, like, you know, nobody can do this for us. We can liberate ourselves. We're like the only ones who can liberate ourselves and stuff. And just telling like these people who had normally been oppressed in this, you know, society on Mars, saying, okay, you gotta like take charge of your own destiny, you know, and that's which is pretty huge.
Yeah, yeah, no, message. It is really interesting, especially you know, how a lot of the themes in Soviet films share. There's a lot of commonalities between that and like the ideology of like egalitarianism, and you know, like striving to like, you know, break free from the chains of capitalism
and relations of production and Marxism. Right?
Yeah, it is really interesting just how political a lot of these films are, and they're very, very optimistic too. Mm-hmm. Like I think it has a lot of elements of like, you know, like a lot of progressive ideology in it, and seeing technology as like a tool that can be used for like the advancement of civilization, how it can be like combined with communism to create a more equal society.
Yeah.
So I think that is that those kind of themes are really interesting.
They are. And you can see like that whole optimism, like there was a lot of that. I mean, after the whole obviously after the revolution succeeded, I mean, it was just, and you know, they fought and won the Russian Civil War, and like it's just like communism was here to stay in Russia, and it's like, wow, you know, like the sky's the limit. Like now we're gonna like get down, we're gonna do things ourselves, we're gonna better our way of life. And as they going through the 1930s and stuff like that, and we start like seeing public healthcare and universal education and all these things which had never been seen in Russia before. And they're all like now they're in the reach of everybody, you know, and like there's cultural institutions and theaters are being built, and like, everybody now has access, and they're like, reaching like 90% literacy rates and stuff like that. And like even today, like Russia has one of the highest literacy rates in the world. Like it's higher than Canada's.
Really?
You know, oh yeah.
Wow, I didn't know that.
I mean, when I was over in Russia, and I've mentioned this a few times on this show, but on the subway and like on the just on street corners and stuff, everybody's like reading. Everybody's reading. Like you see that way more often than like here in Canada. Like you compare like to the Moscow metro to like the TTC. You know, you see there's way more people reading on the metro than there is in reading in Moscow than there's reading in Toronto.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
It's a part of their culture there. They just eat it up. And I guess it's just because, I mean, before the revolution you had like 75% illiteracy rates. Like before 1917.
So only 25% of the population was literate.
Pretty much could functionally read and write.
Yeah,
like it was absolutely incredible, the kind of disparity there, and like most people just totally cut off from like really any sort of like print, like written word or like that entire cultural scene was just closed to them, you know. So I mean, after everybody was like learning to read and write, and I was like really, really encouraged, you know, like, you know, coming to read and write, and just, you know, you can, a world of possibilities would open to you then. And it wasn't, you have like peasants becoming like, engineers and doctors and like all these other things because their potential is unlocked. You know, now it's like they're not locked in that subordinate position anymore.
Wow.
And so that was absolutely huge. I don't think it's honestly, like, I don't know of any other equivalent in human history with that kind of turnaround.
Yeah. No, that's actually really interesting. I didn't know that. And it's especially, you know, interesting given the fact that I think a lot of people would associate the Soviet Union with, like, censorship and sort of, you know, political repression in that sense.
Mm.
So that is really interesting that it had the opposite effect, and people actually, you know, more people started reading.
Well, yeah. I mean, during the cold run, here's another thing a lot of people don't know too much about, but I mean, it's actually, the numbers are there. The during the cold war, actually, like, 2/3 of the books in the world were actually published in the Soviet Union.
Really?
Like, they just like turned out tons of like really cheap, just cheap books that they could just, you know, distribute around the world. Like, and we're talking like translations of like Charles Dickens and like Plato and like all kinds of like, you know, philosophy, literature, just publishing cheap editions that anybody can buy and read.
Wow.
Can go like anywhere in the world, and like this kind of stuff like was exported all over the place, like Latin America and Africa and all this sort of stuff. They were printing all this stuff. It's like for the masses, right? Knowledge for the masses.
Yeah.
Anybody can get this stuff. It's not like it's not for profit, you know? And it was just, yeah, like you had these like international publishers and like the various other publishing houses in Moscow and all these other places in the Soviet Union that were just turning out like this kind of stuff, like, you know, worthwhile stuff, you know? Like it's pretty, it's not just like turning out like tons of Marx or Engels or anything like that. You know, they print that too, but I mean, it's like a whole spectrum of authors
incredible.
Here. They're just like turning it and just like, you know, making accessible to people.
Wow, 2/3 you know? Of the books.
Yeah, like I'm serious. You know, like in the world.
Yeah,
like for a while, like
in
the 60s and 70s and stuff. You know, and it's just new. It's absolutely mind blowing. But that actually is that's actually real.
Wow.
You know, and.
I wonder if they were publishing
that blew
any,
my
like,
mind.
Any like Adam Smith or any like, you know, capitalist books or.
Well, maybe I know Yugoslavia published that stuff to critique it, you know,
because
they I don't think it was part of the curriculum, say, in the Soviet Union. But I know in Yugoslavia, they talked about that because it was more largely because they weren't so much in a state of siege. They were a lot more relaxed in terms of like the kind of the kind of stuff they could let in. And interestingly enough, like, I mean, this isn't about Yugoslavia, this show, obviously, but I mean. That's almost like where you saw the most advancement of, say, socialism, maybe what would appear if there wasn't, like, a, you know, a Cold War going on. You know, where, like, you know, more, like as opposed to spending tons of money on, like, nuclear missiles and stuff like that, they actually are free to spend all their money on human services and empowering people. I mean, there was, like, they had days, like, in the school system in Yugoslavia where, like, you know, students would take the role of teachers and stuff like that and, like, just role reversals and just, like, get them, you know, so they have some responsibility. So, like, they see what things are like.
I would have loved to have seen that in my high school.
Yeah, like, wouldn't that be classic?
Yeah, although I don't know how well it would have gone over knowing
Well,
some of the
this
people.
This is like elementary schools even, you know, would do this. Like, 7-year-olds would, like, you know, just go up and, okay, you're going to be the teacher for a while, you know, like for a day or something like that, you know, and it's like, all right. Or they take turns being teacher for a day, this kind of stuff. And it's like, yeah, there was just a lot more freedom there. And so, yeah, but once again, getting back to our subject here,
we kind of digressed a little bit.
But, you know, once again, there's so much to talk about. But I suppose we should probably play our first song. And like, I want to kind of start with a thing that actually came out in 1970, this thing. And once again, it's a track from a movie. The movie's called Rhythms of Absheron, and the song is actually called Rhythms of Absheron as well. It's kind of the theme music for it. And this was by a guy named Polat Bulbul Ogli. He's from Azerbaijan, and he was really big in terms of like writing these scores for a lot of these kind of films. And in terms of where electronic music kind of comes from, the Soviet Union, this kind of is this is more funky than say electronic, but this is kind of like it's songs like this. Which kind of like laid the foundation for the kind of stuff that came afterwards. So this is kind of like almost the beginning of this whole movement in Soviet music. So I'm going to play this for you now. It's pretty short. It's like a two minute song, but I think it kind of illustrates kind of the origins. So we'll start with that.
Yeah, let's have it.
So there we go. We'll be right back. So that's kind of like a kind of a little intro, I guess you could say.
Yeah, I liked that. Yeah. It was really upbeat.
Yeah, so it's kind of like a little jazzy, pretty funky there. But I mean, that's kind of, you can also kind of see the electronic elements which are kind of coming in, and kind of like you know, taking it to a different level, you know, as opposed to just like, you know, your you know, straight up funk or something like that. You know, this is like a it's kind of moving forward in a different direction. Like, once again, as I said before, this, so much of this happens, centers around a lot of like the sci-fi kind of stuff which is going on at the time, because I mean, you get that whole the optimism, say, even like Soviet culture, so much of that gets manifest in sci-fi movies.
You know,
talking about like how you know, how humanity will evolve, and like how just all kinds of things will become possible and will open up. So I mean, this is
Do you know much about the film that was the opening for?
Not really.
No.
Because I mean, I haven't actually seen that anywhere, like in like outside of Russia, you know. Like, I mean, I'm assuming you could have probably accessed that in Russia somehow. But I mean, like over here, like, I don't think there's any like translation or any of that kind of stuff. I've only seen like clips on YouTube. That's about it.
Hmm.
You know.
Yeah, I guess a lot of these movies are hard to find.
Yeah, it's too bad, because I mean, so much of this stuff is, you know, this is pretty high quality stuff. And it would be great if more people could have access to it and kind of see a different side of say the Soviet Union, Soviet culture that you know, then say the mainstream narrative really allows for, right? Because usually we're not going to get access to this kind of stuff. And yeah, probably the best place to go with this, like, I mean, you compare this to say like a track like that in a sci-fi movie in 1970. Compare it to a movie, a track from another sci-fi movie, which came out about like 10 years later. And that movie was called Through the Thorns to the Stars. So once again, this whole image of, you know, getting through like all this turmoil and stuff like that, and then boom, you know, spread your wings and fly. That's like the kind of the revolutionary feel.
Okay. Yeah, so now, what was the plot of this one?
So the plot of this one, like, once again, this one's a little, there's not too much, I don't really know that much about this one either, but there, once again, there is a lot, there is that kind of theme, that very optimistic theme, like, to a lot of these. And it wasn't just movies. I mean, there's a lot of like comics, out there as well that, like some of these things, like, I don't know who put it together, but, when they're playing these tracks, like on YouTube, they will actually have like, Soviet era comic strips in the background, like sci-fi comics, or something like these.
Interesting.
These like explorers going into like some unknown planet, and they're like encountering like monsters and things like that, and they have to like fight to survive, and it's really amazing. And so yeah, like it's pretty interesting. In fact, before I play this, I want to because there is another step in the evolution, I would say, between this and this next track from the 1981 movie Through the Thorns to the Stars, and this is a. This is some electronic music from about 1974, actually. So I'm going to play this, and then I'll play the one from 1981, just playing back to back, and you kind of see how the kind of change between them, and kind of how it progresses. So I think that's how we'll do it. That sounds good, right?
Yeah,
that sounds jolly good.
Let's hear it.
Yeah. We'll be right back. That was like so chill. That was like really chill stuff right there. That was Alexei Rybnikov with Through the Thorns to the Stars. That was like the theme for the music for the movie there. And I actually have the plot summary of the movie up here now.
Yeah, we were able to find that.
So basically, this is the summary goes as follows. 23rd century, a reconnaissance starship discovers a dead alien spaceship of unknown origin in deep space. The crew are found to be humanoid bodies made by an advanced cloning process. One humanoid woman appears to be alive, but has memory loss and is brought back to Earth. Scientist Sergei Lebedev settles her in his own house and names her Nia. Sometime later, Nia finds out that she has supernatural abilities, and Prof. Ivanova finds a special neural center in her brain, which can be used to control the humanoid clones. Nia suddenly remembers her home planet of Dessa, where businessmen eager for easy money destroy nature. A rescue mission with Nia on board is sent to her home planet. When she arrives there, her brain falls under the control of the neurowaves of a local monopolist, Turanchox, who is trying to make the Earth expedition fail. However, Nia is strong enough to resist the control and saves her civilization from an imminent catastrophe. Isn't that interesting compared to, like, you know, where we're at today, where there's like, almost like, you know, eco-apocalypse could be on the horizon and here on Earth, you know?
Yeah, for sure.
This kind of stuff.
I like that, how the antagonists in the film are capitalist businessmen.
Yeah, like, and this is in a future world that like now risks destruction because you know, accumulation has reached the point where it's threatening the world's survival, right? Like that's pretty huge.
Yeah. Sounds a little familiar.
Yeah, I was actually debating that whole thing with a bunch of people earlier this week. It was interesting because they kind of equated like any, you know, they basically said, look, okay, is capitalism the problem or is it just industrialization? And like I was saying, well, industrialization itself is kind of like a tool. You know, it's like, okay, you just allows you to produce like tons and tons of stuff, you know, very, very fast and with like relatively minimum, you know, expenditure and stuff like that. So, I mean, it's kind of like it's the tool and it's like out of the bag. It's all over the place now. It's not like we can put that genie back in the bottle. And it's more or less just how do you use industrialization? And, like, industrialization, do you use that to, like, meet human needs? Do you use that to produce, like, a lot of useless crap that, you know, like the new iPads, new iPhones, and, like, all these gimmicks and stuff like that, and just, you know, burn up all kinds of resources for it because you want to serve your bottom line, you know, accumulate, you know, tons of profit in your name, and there's no end to it. There's no end point to that. It's just, you know, use the world like it's an infinite resource. Or do you build public housing? Do you build like, you know, public transit systems that are like sustainable and like monorails and all kinds of things like that? You know, like what do you do? Like how do you use industrialization? You know, and I mean, so much about like in Marxism, like this is kind of like a segue here, but I mean, so much in Marxism itself, like the whole idea of communism. Communism, like for it to be realistic at all, you have to like live in harmony with the world, with the earth. Right? Like we kind of have to reach that point where it's like industry has kind of reached a point where it's like, okay, it doesn't leave that kind of ecological footprint that we see now. And it's not based on like endless accumulation. It's just based on like, okay, producing for human needs, you know, and it's developed methods where it can just be, that can be done and you have a sustainable economy and that can just be perpetuated and all this kind of stuff. So, I mean, that's more or less what has to happen for communism to be feasible. You know?
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's, like, industrialization, once again, that's going to be there. I mean, there's a difference between industrialization, you know, and capitalism, which is just, you know, accumulating and just exploit every corner of the world and all that kind of stuff, right? I mean, it's, yeah. So that was an interesting debate I had, you know, coming in from that. But you actually were pointing out something which I didn't actually remember, otherwise I would have prepared it ahead of time. But we were talking about the theremin.
Yeah, the theremin. I think it's a really fascinating instrument, actually.
Elaborate on what it is and
yes,
that kind of thing.
Yeah, for sure. It was the world's first electronic instrument. And it essentially looks kind of like a little antenna, and it sends out radio waves. And then in order to play it, you have to put your hands around the antenna, and the radio waves bounce off of your hands, and then they hit the antenna again.
Yep.
And then that makes various sounds at different frequencies. And it's apparently a very difficult instrument to play because you have to be very precise in your hand movements. So it's a Yeah, it's a really, really interesting instrument. And again, it was invented by a Russian.
Whose name was Theremin.
Yeah, whose name was Theremin. And he actually, Lennon was really interested in the theremin. Lennon was a big supporter of it, and actually personally got lessons from Theremin on how to play his instrument.
Yeah.
Which I thought was really interesting. And,
yeah, because he's inventing this in like the beginning of around 1920 or so.
Yeah, yeah.
He's coming up with this this idea, which is like the first electronic instrument really ever. And it's actually come up in some rather interesting places because, I mean, we have, once again, we have even the Star Trek theme, which of course everybody knows.
Actually, I think we're going to play that next. A lot of people don't know that the Star Trek theme used the theremin.
Actually, in terms of a sample of like what it sounds like, I mean, it's basically playing in the background for like the entire of the entirety of the track.
Yeah, yeah,
and the half that it goes on for.
Yeah, and not just Star Trek. Like it was very common in sci-fi films, throughout the 20th century. Actually, from the 40s to even to the present day, just because it does have a very a very electronic sound to it. I don't know if that's the best way to describe it.
Electronic sound.
But I guess we just have to play the theme before we can
more or less
talk
we
about
do.
It. Yeah.
So
it's kind of hard to describe a sound.
It is hard to describe a sound. So let's just go right into it. And this is the Star Trek theme, and you will hear the theremin in the background. So please stay tuned. This is Back in the USSR.
Space, the final frontier. These are the voyages of the starship Enterprise. Its five-year mission, to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no man has gone before.
So there you have it. And that whole, the theremin itself is actually that whole, electronic sound that you get in the background of that with that really high-pitched
Yeah.
Which almost, it makes kind of a soprano kind of noise, And the first time I heard that, I thought that was a woman's voice.
Yeah, but, me too, actually.
But it's not. That is actually produced by an instrument. And, that's just the noise it makes. Like, you can bring up to that pitch. And just keep it there because, of course, it's electronic sound waves. You're just kind of directing with your hands.
Yeah, yeah. And I would highly recommend anyone out there who's interested in the theremin, look it up on YouTube. There are so many videos of people playing the theremin. And a lot of it is just really, really random songs, like a lot of pop songs or like video game songs. And people just play them on the theremin.
Songs.
Yeah. And it's really great. Like, it can actually really... replicate the human voice pretty well. I'm not saying it necessarily sounds human, but just it almost sounds like singing, like we just said in the Star Trek theme, like it sounds like a woman's voice. It sounds like a woman, singing like a falsetto.
Yeah, like a falsetto.
Yeah, yeah.
Voice, yeah.
So it just has a really unique sound to it. Yeah, look it up. Crazy by Gnarls Barkley. That's a really good one.
Like, they actually do a theremin.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know if anyone out there knows. It's a popular song. I think a lot of people would know that. But yeah, like, look up Crazy by Gnarls Barkley, played on the theremin. It sounds incredible.
Like, it's just really out there kind of.
Yeah. And it's just, it's interesting to watch, too. It's interesting to watch people play it because, it's not like a conventional instrument where you're playing a string or you're, hitting a, hitting a key or anything like that. You know, people are you watch somebody who's playing it and they're literally just kind of like moving their hands slightly around this, you know, antenna. So it looks almost comical to watch, but it's very interesting.
Because it's like two like antennas or two things side by side. You just kind of like move your hands, like you're kind of in between.
Yeah.
These two kind of like focal points of like electric energy and stuff, and you're just like kind of channeling. Yeah, it's like you're manipulating those like with your hands, and it's like it's like you're in the zone, you're involved. Like,
you're
totally immersed.
You really are. It almost looks like you're casting a spell or something. I've wanted to build a theremin for years now. Apparently, it's fairly simple to do, but I haven't got around to it.
You do well. There's probably all kinds of like plans and stuff like that on the.
Yeah, I think you can buy a kit to build one for like maybe $50, $100.
$50?
Yeah, like it's not a lot of money, but yeah, also
that's okay.
Also, going back to Star Trek, I also think it is really interesting as well that in the main cast, one of the main characters was Chekhov, who was
a Russian.
Yeah, who's actually a Russian. So which right now that doesn't seem radical at all, but back
during the Cold War,
in the 1960s, during the height of the Cold War, having a Russian cast member. In a lead, position, he's one of the commanding officers on the Enterprise.
Yeah.
And so, I think that, I really like that. I really like, Gene Roddenberry's vision and his sort of, his sense of egalitarianism. Because then you have, it's a very diverse cast. I mean, obviously there's white males, but then there's also, one of the main characters is an African-American female. And then we have the Chekhov, who is a Russian. Mm-hmm. So I think it was a really... I don't know. It was a really nice gesture, especially in such a tense time, just having a really diverse cast.
Yeah. One of the main cast members is even human.
Yeah. Even human. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
Like, come on.
Thank you for bringing that up. Yeah. And then you have Spock, who's half human, but half Vulcan as well.
Yeah. So, yeah, even that says something.
Yeah. So right? I think that is, it's really, really incredible. And especially, at a time when a lot of science fiction was very dystopian. And like a lot of science fiction, was looking at more like potential negatives that could happen in the future. I think that Star Trek, and still is very, very positive.
Mm-hmm. And of course you see, you compare that to like, say, a lot of the sci-fi stuff that's out there, like about zombie apocalypses and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Like Walking Dead and 28 Days Later and like all kinds of stuff.
The list
goes on and on, like about these, like series, and some people are like really fascinated by like zombie phenomenon and stuff like that. And more or less it's just... I guess it's the whole idea of like a civilization in decay and like, eventually the end has to come and the whole thing's just going to go up in flames. That's like standard dystopian kind of fare, and like you see it all the time now. Like the whole idea of like this radically better kind of future is one of the things. I mean, it's just a lot of people have a hard time envisioning it now, and that's sad to see, because you compare that like to say, the kind of visions you see in a lot of these sci-fi things that are coming out in the Soviet Union or
even
Star Trek even, it's totally different.
Yeah, definitely.
Like we get to this different place where we don't have to worry about like all this kind of crap we're dealing with like here in say the 20th century, the 21st century.
Yeah,
like we've been through that. Like that's over.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, yeah, and again, like I think that it all comes down to the Cold War as well, and looking at after the end of the Second World War and the rise of nuclear technology and nuclear arsenals. Like I think a lot of people were rather pessimistic about the future, and so I think that is reflected in a lot of science fiction. But I think that's honestly one of the reasons why sci-fi is one of my favorite genres, is just because it does provide such a great reflection of our own society.
Big time.
Yeah, like I think all good science fiction contains some sort of social criticism about our society and how we might end up and ways we could improve or ways that we might end up destroying ourselves.
Yeah, it's just like, like a lot of it's just like, don't do this. Don't go down this road.
Yeah.
Because it will, you're going to be, like it will mess you up.
Yeah.
Like this kind of stuff.
Yeah. But then, there are
like
some more positive ones as well. Like, again, Star Trek, I think is a great example. Both, the original series and TNG, I would look at them as very positive.
Yeah.
In terms of, how.
Well, compared to a lot of stuff, that's for sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Unlike, and then you have the opposite spectrum. I'd say, again, like zombie films, Fallout, those kind of video games, Fallout.
Those post-apocalyptic kind of games.
Yeah. I got another one. I'd recommend this, any listeners out there. It's a 1975 sci-fi film called The Boy and His Dog.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I've heard of it.
Have you heard of it?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a very strange movie. Like, it's odd. Let's just say that. But, yeah, it takes place in the U.S. in the future after a nuclear holocaust, essentially. And the U.S. has been rendered basically a giant wasteland. And it's about this guy who has a psychic connection with his dog because of radiation.
Yeah, so and, he's a mutant.
Yeah, kind of, yes. And he has this, you know, telepathic capability with his dog, and him and his dog just travel around the wasteland, and they're, you know, rummaging around for old cans of food.
Old cans of food.
Yeah. It's
scavenging, right?
Yeah. And then they come into conflict with this this underground sort of utopian society who live in a fallout shelter, actually. And they turn out to be quite, you know, not quite utopian, but I won't spoil it. So that's my film recommendation for the week.
Yeah, that's your film. Hey, there we go, right?
Sorry, it isn't Soviet, but...
Well, still, it's that's probably more accessible than some of the other things we're talking about here.
Yeah, it is, right? In English.
Yeah, that's what we're talking about, so check that out. You know, take Sean's recommendation there. So yeah, let's play a few more here. We have this is one from 1984. This is N. Sokolov's tune. It's called Safari. So this is more like electronic kind of music, just kind of taking this forward. And just the immense diversity of this kind of stuff too. Like this is once again, this is like they as soon as you start the whole like electronic ball rolling, it seems like you just can go anywhere. So please stay tuned. This is Back in the USSR.
С поворотами туловища. И влево, вправо, влево, вправо, влево, вправо, влево, вправо. Изгибание ног с поочередным выпрямлением.
Должна лететь я. Я это биолог. gave the duel.
What way of it?
There we go. You had Krivitsky with Cassiopeia, and that's Call of Robots. So once again, you got the whole like sci-fi feel there. And Sokolov with Safari. Once again, kind of those. They're pretty distinct tracks, but I mean, you can kind of see like electronic music in the Soviet Union, the kind of diversity that it had. It's not like all the same kind of stuff, right? I mean, it's
really
took it in a lot of different directions.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, both those were really chill tracks, you know, especially for a song called Safari bracket 1984.
Yeah.
I was expecting it to be a bit more dystopian, but
yeah.
But yeah, no, well, it was upbeat.
Yeah, like I was when I was like, you should see me when I was first discovering these tracks, and I was just like, you know, checking them out on my laptop, and I was just like, you know, sitting back, like, I was chilling, you know, like for like about an hour or so, I was just chilling, looking at all these different tracks, and it's a shame we haven't got time for all of them tonight.
Well, we could always, you know, maybe do a part two.
Yeah, we could still do like a part two, like in a few weeks' time or something like that. That would be jolly good.
Yeah, we could always do that.
And besides, we got like, you know, you said like Ayrton wants to come in.
We should really get Ayrton again. In on this.
Because he said he wanted to come in for his show. Once again, this is the other dude from Distorted Reality, other lovely host. And so he expressed his desire to come in and be on Back in the USSR in December as well. So
yeah,
we could do this then.
Yeah, I think there's definitely some good potential for some possible theme ideas. You know, we could do Russian video games. That could be one.
Obviously, it wasn't really
Russian film.
Film. Yeah. You know, like, well, once again, like the whole Soviet. I didn't research that enough for tonight, obviously, but we could go further into that and find like all this theme music and stuff. I mean, that'd be jolly good. Because I mean, I just feel. One of the things I'm back in the USSR, we're talking so much about like the various issues going on today, and that's important. But we're not like going into more, say, the cultural context of, say, the Soviet Union, which I really want to like explore a lot as well, because that's a whole, you know, huge part of history that doesn't get talked about too much. Right?
Yeah, for sure.
Like, who looks into that stuff?
You know, yeah, and yeah,
I know think, of around
yeah,
here.
And a lot of people, you know, in the West have misconceptions about, you know, the Russia
they,
and
they
you know,
wouldn't
the
think stuff like this would be possible or
yeah, you know. Yeah, you know, it's all behind the Iron Curtain, you know, they don't know.
Yeah.
I guess a lot of people wouldn't be well informed about, you know, a lot of, you know, the culture of the USSR.
Yeah. Well, some of the first music I played on this show, of course, was like East German rock and roll, like from the 1970s and 80s.
Nice.
You know, like in Polish rock and roll from the same time and you know, like all this kind of stuff. I mean, it's like there's all this stuff that, you know, you can find if you look around the internet and stuff, and just people don't even know what's there.
Well,
you know, it's a sad state of affairs. So it's like, okay, we're going to introduce them to it here.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's the thing. A lot of people just never, you know, get out of their comfort zone and aren't willing to, you know, look up new
stuff.
New music.
And that's too bad. Because you will find whole new worlds if you do that. To be dramatic.
Yeah. No, it's true.
You know, like, yeah, like stuff you've never thought was possible before. Yeah, I think, this one's really good. You want to like a really, really chill track to kind of wind things down with? We have, this is Gravitsky with Plutonia. This one's really good. So, yeah, I think we'll come back and we're going to sign off after this. So this is kind of going to be our last track. But yeah, stay tuned for what is left of Back in the USSR. You know, I could like, that's like lullaby kind of territory right there. I could like fall asleep to that music.
Yeah, yeah. No, definitely relaxing music. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that was once again Krivitsky. Yakov Krivitsky was the guy who actually created that, as he also created the Call of Robots song about that. And he's like an animator and music producer in the 1980s in the Soviet Union. And Plutonia itself, we couldn't actually find like the actual movie. Interesting enough, we just did a search here. But we did find a novel. And the novel Plutonia is a novel released in about 1915 by Vladimir Obruchev. So he's a Russian writer. And it's kind of like a Hollow Earth type science fiction novel set in an underground world of rivers, lakes, volcanoes, and strange vegetation, which has its own sun, Pluto, and is inhabited by monstrous animals and primitive people. So it's kind of like this underground, like lost world kind of thing.
Hmm.
And it's like this came out in 1950, like in the middle of the First World War.
Interesting.
You know? And I'm thinking that's like what the, you know, Plutonia 2010 is kind of like a film adaptation of this book, I'm thinking, but I...
Yeah, it would
we couldn't
make,
find
it would
confirmation of that.
Yeah, it is kind of strange that we're able to find some music from the soundtrack of this film, but we're unable to
find the film itself.
The film itself or really
that's,
anything
that's
about
a problem.
It. Yeah. Well, I mean, I guess it's... you know, pretty obscure territory we're going into. Like
it is
the music from, you know, Russian, you know, Soviet science fiction films from like the early 20th century.
Yeah, but once again, this is only the beginning, right? Because we're planning on going back to this in a few weeks, right? So
yeah.
We can find out stuff about this sort of thing, like in the meantime, and come back and inform our people when we get back and
well,
like pick this up again.
It's good. Give listeners something to look forward to.
Exactly. You know, we got to have you got to be ready for stuff like that.
These mysteries, you know, they need to be unraveled.
There are many mysteries in this world. Many mysteries indeed. It's like, yeah, did you take the labels off the cans again? It's like, yep.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah.
Yeah.
And it's like, Jesus.
What am I eating tonight? Is it going to be like, beans or like chopped liver?
It could be anything, you know.
Tangerines, I don't know.
Yeah, like there's imagine no if you were doing that to people with dietary restrictions. Yeah, that would just like, oh my God. That would just be cruel.
Yeah.
That would be so cruel, you know, like doing that to them. So it's like, yeah, they wouldn't know. And they would have grave consequences. So, but anyway, that's about all the time we have for Back in the USSR. So I want to thank Sean for being here with us. And
yeah, thank you very much for having me on your show.
Yeah, and I guess we're going to have you back here and maybe Ayrton as well in a few weeks' time, and we can kind of pick this up again.
Yeah, I know. It'd be great, especially having the three of us on the air again.
Yeah, like all of us like on the air again together.
It's been
old times.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, but that's all the time we got. So I will see you all here next week.
До свидания.
Exactly. Пека. We all know each other very well. That's the if you know the person, right? Mm. There we go. There's once again, yeah,
I didn't actually know that.
Oh, yeah, that's if your camaraderie with them.
Then, and Dos Vidania is more like informal?
It's more informal, yeah.
Okay.
There we go. So there we go.